The Witness the World podcast represents the personal views of the host and guests at the time of recording. These views may change over time. The content here is for informational and entertainment purposes only. Any content here should not be construed as financial, medical, or any other type of professional advice. Please consult with a qualified practitioner should you require any professional advice. Good day, everyone. Welcome to episode 7 of the Witness the World podcast. My name is Ben Choi, and today we'll be heading over to Australia. Our guest has battled through many debilitating conditions throughout her life, including anorexia nervosa, mental illness, and depression. Her struggles lasted for many years, but she has managed to persevere and now helps others through their personal battles. Today, we'll learn about her transformation from survivor to practitioner and how her experiences have made a positive impact. We'll also explore what are some of the root issues behind these conditions so we might be better equipped to support others. JL Keys, thanks for joining us today.
Good morning or good afternoon for where you are in the world today. Lovely to be here with you, and I'm looking forward to having our conversation and for your listeners to hopefully gain and learn from that and inspire themselves with their stories that they might be bringing to the listening of this today. So looking forward to it. Thank you for having me.
Excellent. So JL, I probably thought I'd start off with your LinkedIn profile when I was doing a little reading about you. You listed yourself as a certified reality therapy counselor. Until I read your profile, I never seen that description before, but I kind of like it because, you know, dealing with reality, I think, is very important today, even more than ever. So just wondering if you could start us off by just describing on a high level, like what a certified reality therapy counselor does.
Well, a certified reality therapy counselor uses a platform that was first designed by an American psychiatrist called Dr. William Glasser. And I came across this particular modality for healing at the age of 37, when I finally met the right person who asked me the right questions and therefore guided me out of all of the illnesses that I was experiencing at that time. So this is a model that, like its words suggest, it's built on reality and the reality of your life. So it has a lot of elements to it, and all of those elements come together to create a picture for the client that they can then work with and together with their, the counsellor. In this case, it might be me. And what we do is we guide our clients to look at, first of all, their thinking. So what is the thinking that you're currently carrying, and how does that connect to the illness that you're presenting with here in my room today? So let's look at your thinking. How does that thinking impact your behaviours, and how together do they impact your emotional status? And then together, where in the physical body is this currently being carried? And once we begin to look at those aspects of a person, we begin to put together a story of their life, if you like, and we begin to identify those areas that need to be worked on and explored and examined so that we can do some recovery and some healing in those areas of their life. We then extend it a little bit further and we look at the needs and wants of a person, and are those needs and wants being met by this particular client? And if there are gaps in the needs and the wants are those things that you like to have in life that bring you joy, those extra little embellishments, if you like, that put a smile on your face. And, you know, I found when I went through it, I didn't have a lot of those sorts of things being satisfied in my life, and that can create an unhappiness in itself. And then in reality therapy, we look at five needs, and one of the needs is survival. So I had that. I had money and I had a roof over my head and I had food to eat and clothes to wear. So survival was being met for me. Love and belonging is another need that we focus on. And when I really explored that area of my life, love and belonging was pretty lacking. So we needed to do something about that as well. Another one is power. And I don't mean power over, I mean empowerment. You know, are you empowered in your life or is someone else having power over your life? And I had a lot of people having power. Well, I allowed other people to have power over my life. So I needed to do something about that as well. And fun is another one, and freedom. Gosh, I've remembered them. How grateful. So, did I have freedom? And by that, we mean, do you feel free from within to be able to make the decisions and the choices that reflect who you are and in your life moving forward? And I discovered that I didn't have that freedom. You know, my world and my perception of the world was certainly influenced by the messages that I had received in my childhood and my life moving forward. And I was living by that perception. So I was quite a shut down person as well. And there certainly wasn't a lot of fun going on because I didn't have the ability or strength, you know, to be able to follow fun. So I had quite a few of those areas that needed addressing in my life as well. And then the other another two areas that we look at is beliefs and values, because your belief system and your value system as a person is really important. If you're not living your beliefs and the values that are important to you, then you've got discord and disruption in your life as well. And then the big one that really opened my eyes at the time was the one of relationship. And so the relationship that we have with ourselves obviously is very important. And I was berating myself all the time. I wasn't accepting of myself, and I had to keep changing myself because that's what I thought I had to do to be accepted by others. So I needed to really look at and interrogate how I was seeing myself and relating to myself. But more importantly, was the relationships that I had encountered from the time I was born and through till now, and how they had impacted and influenced, and how they were still guiding, if you like, how I lived my life. So there's quite a few areas that we sort of bring in to the healing modality, if you like, and they're all interlinked and all really important. And umbrella course over all of that, when we bring all that together, we come up with the story of our life. And so that was the difference at 37 when I walked into this lady's name is Joan Hookstad, who practiced reality therapy. And one of her early questions was, tell me your story. And let's explore your story, because in that story will be the clues and the solutions that we can work with to for recovery for you to be achieved. So this was the modality that Dr. William Glasser put together after years of working in psychiatry, and what he felt were common grounds and common areas that needed to be explored and brought into the healing process for people. So that's what reality therapy is based on. So, and that was the one that was most helpful for me. And I guess to finish off this little section here, why it works is that anyone who's gone through, so when I went through with Joan and finally found my recovery, of course, I went and studied and became a counselor in this area myself. And one of the most important things that someone in my role has is to build a client practitioner, you know, relationship. The relationship I have with that person is really, really important. If that's not set in stone right from the get-go, then that client may as well go and find somebody else. It's really important for me to know how to set up a really client-based opportunity for that person to explore their life as well. And we have certain stepping stones in making sure that we create that safe environment for them to be able to explore their story and their life and give understanding. And once that understanding comes in, the opportunity for healing unfolds. So that's what reality therapy is all about.
Excellent. Yeah, thanks for that clarity, JL. So it's probably best we dive into, I guess, the relationship with yourself. You were talking about that there and one of your points there. And I think it's important that we kind of see, where you were at and then why you kind of got into this field. And I think for yourself, you mentioned that some of your early struggles, it just started off like in high school, and so from what I was reading, yeah, you were a scholastic and a track superstar per se, and everything's going good. But then, You first experience some bullying, some isolationism. High school can be rough for people, but things started to kind of go to a different path from there, from what I understand. So was that the origins of your own personal struggles, those high school years and finding that validation or trying to be the best you can be, but not quite getting there? I was wondering if you can just take us back there a little bit.
I think the best way to answer that so that people can understand me, my story, and why I ended up developing anorexia is to start with a story and of a little girl who's obviously me. It was my birthday on this particular Sunday, and I turned two on that morning, and I got up all excited. We were a church-based family. I lived on a farm, and we had to drive, a good half an hour to get to the church that we would attend each Sunday morning. And on this particular Sunday morning, I was all excited, and I clambered into the back seat of the Black Zephyr. That's aging me a bit here in Australia. People will know if you're an Australian listener. Somewhere deep inside, my father was driving the car, and my mother was on the other side carrying my new baby sister, and my brother was in the back seat with me. And from somewhere deep inside, I must have thought, this is the moment for whatever reason. I mean, I'm 2 years old, who would know? And I began to tell my story, or to my mother. I began to tell her something that she didn't know that I was experiencing. And lightning fast, my father turned around before I could complete my sentences and ordered me out of the car and whacked me and was pretty, it was a very traumatic experience. And I was thrown out of the car at the age of two and told that I wouldn't be attending church that morning and I had to stay home on my own and close the internal gate so they could, go off to church. And so if you can imagine a two-year-old girl, all excited in 1 minute for her birthday and probably open presents, I don't remember that bit of it. But all of a sudden, I'm in this isolated, huge farm. I'm closing the internal gate and I'm watching that Black Zephyr disappear up over the hill. And in that moment, it's like, I've just done the worst thing. I must have internalized, this is all my fault. I've done the worst thing ever. I should never have begun to open my mouth and tell my mother what I was experiencing. My dad did return and I did go to church, but there was never a conversation. My mother never said, hey, what was that all about? No one nurtured me or nourished me or did anything. It was just like nothing had happened. And I can look back now, knowing my story, and know that that was the beginning of my spiral down, even though it didn't really eventuate until I was 15. And then moving on from there, we left the farm and I became a minister's daughter. And that was isolation in itself back in my day because I was the minister's daughter. I shifted every 3 years. I didn't make friends easily. I was bullied because I was a straight A student, a top athlete, and all of those things. And certainly when I got into, 13, 14, and 15, that's where the bullying and everything escalated. And that's an age when you're starting to want friends and boyfriends and you're starting to be noticed in a different way. And my life was very, very restricted from the parameters of religion that we lived through. And I wasn't allowed to do this and I wasn't allowed to go there. And I couldn't live a normal life like the other young people around me. So that, encouraged more bullying. So at the age of 15, somewhere, with that was my day-to-day life, but it was this trauma at the age of two and what was happening around there that was really the underlying root cause. And it was sexual abuse at the hands of my father. And so no wonder he wanted to silence me very, very quickly. So there were a number of compounding experiences and life events that culminated at the age of 15 that saw me somewhere in here go, no one likes me. Well, that was the threat. If you tell anyone what's happening to you, no one will like you. And that sentence, unchanged, remained in my brain as a guide for life moving forward. And with that guide, it was no wonder I walked into every situation going, well, no one likes me anyway. That was my thinking, and that's what played out in front of me. So at 15, got to do something about this athletic body, not good enough. So I dropped the weight. And then for the next 9 years, I did this thing that I didn't know was called anorexia nervosa. And it wasn't until I was 24, I did end up getting married. I did end up becoming a teacher of home economics. And it was one of my teaching colleagues that went, must have had a conversation with her doctor. She was pregnant at the time. And together they colluded to get me into his office and they colluded to get me to a psychiatrist who then presented me with paperwork that was telling me all about me. And the heading was anorexia nervosa. And I could identify with that. And part of me went, oh, well, this is good. You know, I'm going to get well. Fantastic. And then another side of me would come up with deep, deep fear about the thought of actually getting well. And that remained a stumbling block for a long time. So they were the struggles that contributed to the beginning of the downfall at 15. And then at 24, thinking, all right, if I just put weight on, it's all over and I'll get back to a healthy life. Well, unfortunately, that didn't happen. So that downward spiral continued until 37. And I don't know if you want to hear all the rest of that. It's a very big story and there's a lot to, and it's quite often you don't know how much to put in and how much to talk. But that's the basic background to my downfall. And then, of course, I went down and down and down until I was 37 before I started to surface again.
Yeah, no, thanks for sharing that, JL. I think what would be good is maybe we could share a little bit about like what, you know, when you're in the mindset of that struggle, that battle day to day, you know, a lot of people that, you know, aren't going through that struggle or never been through that struggle, they don't understand, you know, what it's like on a day to day, like what your mind's been telling you. And just wondering, like in the height of everything that you've been through, like what was like a typical day like just to get by for you?
Well, you know, as odd as it may sound, for the first couple of years that I was doing that life, I actually went to boarding school down here in Adelaide because I always lived in country environments. And that's why I could get away with it more, because I didn't have anyone around me apart from my school environment. So no one questioned what I was doing. So my day-to-day life was restricting the quantities that I had at breakfast time, lunchtime, and evening meals. And I would stick to a certain amount of food every day. And then I'd be out in the schoolyard, you know, as a boarder, we'd go over into the main school. And during the day, I would see all these other students out on the tennis courts, for example, playing tennis at lunchtime or during study time. And they'd be out having breaks and then coming back to their study. And I think, how can they do that? How can they do all? I can't. I don't know how they've got the energy to do the study and do the physical part of their life as well. And that was a real confusion for me. So I guess I felt like I was living, that everyone else lived like I did. I didn't know I was different to anybody else. I just assumed that how I was living was how everyone next to me was living. But there were no conversations held. Well, no one knew to ask that conversation at all. So there was a lot of confusion about what I saw other people being able to do that I couldn't do. And then, of course, there was that transition from being a top athlete and winning everything and, you know, coming first in everything and breaking records. And then when I went to boarding school, thinking, well, that would just continue on. But when I went out to do the training, I would get halfway around the oval running and I would just go all dizzy and I'd get weak and I couldn't do anything. And because I didn't say it to anybody, no one knew that that was what was happening to me. And so my athleticism just went. And because I'd changed schools again, no one knew I was a top athlete. So no one asked the question, well, how come you didn't win that race? Because they didn't know that that was what I used to always do. So, you know, going from one school to another allowed me to disguise it or to deepen that experience. And then once a week, my body would be so hungry that I would allow myself to eat just a little bit more, which always resulted in eating a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more until I would just stuff myself silly with food and then vow and declare I'd never do it again. But of course it became a weekly cycle. And then the day after filling myself with way too much food and usually high sugar based foods, I would just feel so bloated and sick and horrible and just could not wait to go to bed and get rid of that particular day to go on to the next one. So for me, looking back, look, for those 9 years, I was floundering. No one was asking the questions, so I didn't know I was different, but I knew my physical experience was different, but I didn't know why. So it was a hugely confusing time. And I really didn't understand what I was doing until at 37, I met Joan Hoogstad Reality Therapy, and we could go back and look at the story of my life and put understanding to all of those phases that I had lived through up until then. So, yeah, it was a very lonely, very just one, and I was filling up with fear. I'd like to stress that as well, because once again, we don't know. Well, I didn't know that the fears that I were carrying and going into situations and filling with fear, and I didn't know that the people next to me weren't having that same fear experience, and they seemed to be coping with it a lot better than me. And I was sort of, well, what's wrong with me? Why can't I cope like everybody else? But yeah, no one asked the question, so I just kept living it until I didn't.
Thanks for taking us back there again, JL. So you mentioned 37, and I'm curious to know, like, that sounds like that's the turning point, but before you found that practitioner to kind of help guide you, I mean, was there like an internal turning point for you, a light bulb moment that, hey, you know, I got to find some different kind of help here to get me on the right path?
Look, I did. It was when I did fall pregnant at the age of 27 with my son. And that was a panic time, because all of a sudden I had a child on board, and I knew that I wasn't well. And I kept asking doctors, look, I'm not well. I shouldn't be, you know, how is this going to impact this growing child? And they kept reassuring me that the baby would be fine. But because I looked fine, because by the time I was 27, I did go through that phase of restoring the weight. And back in my day, it was just put on weight and you'll be fine. So I gradually put the weight on, and that was another, you know, battle in itself. But I got myself there and got myself back to a healthy weight. So I looked healthy and well. But what people couldn't see, that was because I hadn't explored and dealt with the reasons I'd developed anorexia in the first place. That anorexia was now replaced by chronic fatigue. It was replaced by debilitating migraines. OCD came into my life when I got pregnant. Suicidal depression was the last one, but there's another one. Oh, depersonalization. Depersonalization came in. Depersonalization is a feeling like you don't feel like you're on the planet. You don't feel like you're in the room. And, you know, by the end of the day, you forget what you've done at the beginning of the day. And it's a real hard think about, what did I do at the beginning of the day? I was now carrying a whole host of other mental illnesses that no one could define for me or give a reason for. So, you know, my son, that was like, I have to get well. But I just got sicker and sicker. And then 3 years later, I was pregnant with my daughter. And that was the time. We were then living in Victoria, here in Australia at the time, and decided to come back to Adelaide, where I have lived ever since. We were from Adelaide originally, went to Victoria, and then we were just returning home because I wanted my children to be educated here in Adelaide for whatever reason. That was one of my fears that I carried. And it was when I came back to Adelaide, I went, you know what? I have got to get well. I've got two children that rely on me, and I'm missing out on my life here. I am filled with fears, and surely I'm impacting these two developing little people, and I don't want them to end up where I am. So, I mean, in the meantime, I'd gone to naturopaths. I'd gone to a whole range of different people who couldn't help me in any way. So I went and saw a psychiatrist, and then, you know, I kept going and stepping through, desperate to find answers. And it wasn't until I was 37 that my marriage sadly ended, and now I was a single mum. And this lady was actually recommended to me to navigate my way through that, to support my children emotionally through that big change that they were about to experience. And as soon as I walked into that room, because I didn't know, and I didn't know until the end, but my story had once been her story. So she could pick up on the same elements, the same behaviors and thinking patterns that once she lived by, and she could see. And so she worked and worked with me without telling me that she sort of basically knew. And it was her role in my life at that time, with the right questions and the right guidance, that finally saw me break through. And by that stage, there was an absolute strong determination in me that fear was going to leave my life. I didn't know, I didn't care how bad and how many sleepless nights I had living in fear and shaking and everything. I was going to break this pattern. I was going to get through it and change the pattern for my children. So my children were my turning point, I guess. And they gave me the strength and determination to continue going, because there were so many times when I lined the tablets up on my bench, I was going to take them, I was going to leave this planet, and then I realized I was a single mum, and what would that do? What impact would that have on my children? So that wasn't a choice in the end. So there were a few important areas of my life that came into play that, when they all combined together, was a pretty good reason to really fight and begin the battle of pushing through all of this. So, yeah, the turning point came at 37, fueled by a number of things along the way.
Thanks for that, JL. So, yeah, I guess you could say the second part of that recovery journey is 37 and beyond. I'm curious to know, like, when did you know that you had recovered, or recovered significantly, maybe 90% recovered? Like, what does that feel like? Where were you at with things? Like, how did your practitioner help you and, like, kind of give you that, you know, feeling that, yeah, you know what, I have come a long way, and now I'm back to the real me?
I would say it was a gradual thing rather than a sudden thing. Because when I began to do this work with Joan, I realized that I carried an enormous number of fears. And these fears were based on the messages that were taught to me by my life events, if you like, going through, and the strong religious upbringing and the parameters, the boundaries that were put into place by that were filled with fear. You know, you have to do it this way or punishment will come in. You have to do it this way or you'll be punished. I also had a father that punished us severely. He also, you know, so there was a lot of trauma, a lot of punishment and a lot of fear. And that's how I related to life. And when you're undoing fear, it's huge. You know, you think, oh, well, you know, it's not true. Just don't think like that anymore. I remember someone saying that to me before I met Joan. I thought, you've got no idea. Obviously, I haven't lived with fear before. But I started with the little fears and began to conquer those and conquer those and conquer those until I got to the end. And I guess I realized I was at the end when I was able to make a decision based on what I wanted for my life and be at peace with it. Because so many times I would make decisions about things that I wanted to do, about how I wanted to raise my children or whatever. And as soon as I make the decision, it would come this fear. And it would be, oh my gosh, but if they do that, no one will like me. No one will like them. What will people think of them? Oh gosh, I can't do it that way because then, oh, you know, and all of that learned thinking and behavior would come up and get in the way. So then I'd revert back. And my poor son had to be perfect. He had to be the top of his class and he had to be this and he had to be that. And my daughter had to be, you know, I was driving us all nuts. But it was when I finally acknowledged, and I guess a little example, because it's in my head at the moment, I was given one of the best gifts ever. And in both my children, and Brad, I'm not sidelining you here, but Kimberly is they're both performers in their own right, but Kimberly's a very strong-willed, talented performer. The thing that should have been my life as well. And I could identify with her. She was, you know, she wanted to dress like this and she wanted to talk like this and she wanted to wear odd clothes and she wanted to do all of this sort of stuff. And it was always a battle. And it was the day that I was able to say to Kimberly as a little girl, what do you want to wear? And she'd wear it. And look, if her socks didn't match, it didn't matter. And I'd just go up the street with her like that and I'd go shopping. She'd have odd socks on or she'd have this on or her hair done, you know. And it was all very creative and odd, you know. But I could now do it peacefully. I didn't care if someone looked at her sideways or looked at me and said, you know, you're a bad mother or whatever. You know, I thought that, which no one was actually thinking. It was just my learning. So that was when peace and recovery really came through my door and my energy levels picked up and the different illnesses began to fade from my life as well, because Joan helped step me through each of those illnesses and have conversations with them, if you like. And I learned from the different mental illnesses that I carried, the messages that they were wanting to share with me about who I'd become and why I'd become. Not so much who, but why had I become the person that I did in my life. So the turning point was gradual, but I guess there's a lot of times, Yeah, there would be a lot of examples where I would go into a situation, I think, gosh, I did that differently. I just spoke my truth and I've walked away and I don't care. I haven't gone back into that fear of, oh my gosh, what will they be thinking of me now? Or will they not like me for saying that? You know, it was being able to do something and just walk away and being able to dress and put an extra earring in my ear because I had one and I put an extra one in. And, you know, I've added a tattoo on my arm here and that's part of healing and things like that. They might sound like little things or odd things, but it's being able to step outside of the life that I had been taught needed to be lived into the life and to the lane that I belong to and peacefully do it. So, but I can't give you an actual age. I can't say by 43, you know, or whatever. It was a very gradual process because we're looking at someone who had multiple fears, multiple illnesses, and a very long story to have to go into and many, many years to undo. So it was gradual, but we got there.
Thanks for that sharing, JL. I've heard the similar themes with other people. I know for myself, and I have challenges in the past, struggles. Like it's a day-to-day kind of thing, kind of to get yourself on the right path. And no, there's no snap of the fingers from my experience and from what I've heard from others. So yeah, it's a similar path. And yeah, great to hear that you got on the other side of it. And speaking of which, Joan helping you get on the other side of it was. She like the inspiration for you to get into this field, or what did you have another reason to go into the field and it's just you thought you had your this expertise and you want to give back because you are better equipped to help others?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. I think as I went through and got to know Joan, you know, more on a personal level, and I will say it as she said it to me, you know, she said, Jenny Lee, you know, you have an ability here to be able to connect with others and to be able to take your story and deliver it in the, you know, on the platform of public speaking to write it through your book. She could see these other avenues where I could use my story to inspire and help others. So I guess when you're being given that information, and then she gave me the opportunity to do a public speaking gig one day, and the feedback I got from that was very, very encouraging as well. And I'm a secondary school teacher also, and I still do that in a relief role. And you know, students in my care, you could see them struggling in different ways, and you'd have parent-teacher interviews, and you go, oh my gosh. Don't do that to your child, you know, and you could see why this child was struggling because reality therapy opened my eyes to how we relate as a society and therefore how we impact each other. And so once you get that knowledge, you don't sort of want to just leave it at the door. You want to be able to inspire and give that gift, I guess, to other people, particularly in eating disorders as well. I'd had this huge life and this huge experience. And it didn't seem right to just leave it there. So, yes, I wanted to explore and get into the area of, okay, how can I mean, Joan had been such a huge assistance to me. And I guess she was really pushing me as well. It's Jenny Lee, come on, come on, come on. You've got this gift, you've got this ability, you've got this. And, you know, so it was pushing from her. It was also from my select group of friends. Not a lot of people knew that I was suffering at all. I didn't talk about it out in the what I call the real world. I kept the real world real for me and my children, as real as it could be. I didn't talk about what I was experiencing. I didn't share it with other people. No one around me knew that I was struggling, deeply struggling with a lot of things. And that was done on purpose for so that I could have a real life with my children and not drag other people through it. So I had my close-knit of people that were supporting me. And when I'd come through, they said, Jael, you know, this is your life's work, your life's calling. And because they saw the depths of despair and they saw, you know, at the other end. So it was the encouragement of a lot of people. And yeah, I couldn't just leave it at the door. I felt I had way too much to offer and give. And I certainly started to apply that in my classrooms with different students. And I could see the difference that I made by employing the ideas of reality therapy, even within my classroom. So when you see that, you want to share that and you want to open people's eyes so that other people don't struggle the same as what I had. or to pull them out of their struggle a lot quicker than I was pulled out of mine. So there's a combination again of reasons why I decided to take this path moving forward.
Excellent. Yeah, thanks for sharing that, JL. And speaking of helping people, I want to turn to what you're doing now to helping people in your practice. Wanted to get your take on what you are seeing these days. The common trends for eating disorders, mental illness, your area of expertise. Are you seeing, things maybe over the last, 2, 3 years, we've had this global health crisis. Has that changed? Eating disorder challenges that people have, or this has always been consistent. Just wondering what you are seeing in the trends in your field.
Well, the statistics each year would say that eating disorders are going up, the number of people that are having them. And I haven't, and this is again just my opinion from, observing this over the years. I don't think it's got anything to do with the pandemic. I think it's to do with, I think, mental illnesses and eating disorders and any expression of an eating of, a mental illness will keep rising in statistics. They will keep happening until, as a society, we understand the why behind it. And that's a frustration, I guess, for me, because I don't know that the actual causative factors in anything have changed. We just haven't got it right yet in really understanding why they develop and why they're increasing. We're not getting the right education to the right people so that we can begin to change. And for me, it's changing how we relate to each other, how we treat each other, how we treat our children from the day, they're put into our arms and we say, g'day. There's a lot of things in there. And it's a bit of a soapbox of mine. I've written it in both of my books that I've got 3 books, but in 2 of them in particular. And it's that how we relate impacts. And I get really frustrated because I see, and I'll use one as an example. Many, many years ago, I did go to Flinders Medical Centre. It's a big hospital here in Adelaide, and it has a weight disorder unit. And I went there as a day, no, as a not, oh, I went there as a day patient, an outpatient, but that I went and had a stay there for 10 days as well, many years ago. And I remember entering that facility and going, what am I doing here? I don't, I'm not sure why I'm here. And then after the 10 days, I went, oh, I've got it now. It didn't present any new ideas for me and my healing overall, but it opened my eyes to what needed to be done better. And once again, this is just my opinion, but I remember sitting at the table with one young lady, and she had a little pot with a lot of tablets in it and every meal that we shared. And I refused to take tablets. So, and I said, oh, what's happening for you? And blah, blah, blah. And she said, oh, look, I just love coming back here. I always get well in here, and I'm always at peace. And but as soon as I go home, I go back into my eating disorder, I lose weight, I do, and the light turned on. I went, environment. Okay. And I thought, well, this is the third time you've come back in here, and no one has made that connection about environment. In here, she felt safe. There was no one challenging her in any way. She wasn't under stress. But out there in the real world, there was a stress for her. There was a fear for her. What was going on for her? And why wasn't that being explored and resolved for her so that she could eliminate the eating disorder in the real world as well as in this cushioned, hospital environment here? So for me, I think it's not pandemic, it's not any of those other sorts of things that we might make excuses for as to why mental illness is getting worse. We're not understanding the dynamics that bring them about in the first place. And for me, that is the fear factor. When kids are filled with trauma, when kids are raised by in an environment that criticizes them, blames them, bullies them, and all of those things, it's got to have an effect. I mean, in our story is held in our brain, and our brain wires according to the story that we hold in here. And then, depending on that wiring, our physical body responds. And the way we view the world around us, we respond to that. And so that to me, until we understand and really grasp that idea and realize that at the grassroots level, we need to change the way we're raising our children, speaking to our children, helping our children navigate life and through the school systems and everywhere, how we relay impacts, I think, is the biggest causative factor. But somewhere along the line, we're not getting it. The other things that I've written down here, because I've got a few notes, Alyssa, sorry, I'm looking away every now and then. Unresolved trauma. You know, sometimes we miss that. And as I went through, that trauma of mine wasn't identified until I was 37 because the right questions weren't asked. Had that trauma been acknowledged back at 15 when I first went into anorexia nervosa, oh my gosh, my life would have been so different. You know, I probably would be a gold-winning medalist or a vocalist, you know, up on the stage or something. But, you know, unresolved traumas that aren't initially identified because they're so carefully hidden by fear, that can put a block and keep a mental illness going. But the fear factor is the biggest thing. And so, you know, we have gamblers, we have eating disorder people, PTSD, we have people that go down a whole range of destructive pathways. But if we bring them all back, they probably all have a very similar base. But then why we choose an eating disorder as opposed to alcoholism or gambling, that might be a family thing. It's just where the body takes it. But then that's the wake-up call to say, hey, why are you doing this? There's something that needs to be resolved. So have I answered that question for you? I feel like I've gotten off track perhaps a little bit there.
No, I think those are some great insights, JL. I think also it would be a great add that maybe you could shed a little bit of light on what are the warning signs, red flags, you know, if we see a friend, family member, perhaps heading down one of those paths, how do we approach them? How do we support them so they can kind of work through it? And sometimes it's going to be a long, protracted journey, but if we can do something to support them and we see some signs they're acting a little differently, like what would you suggest like to us if we see that happen?
That is a really, really difficult one to undertake and do because people that are in mental illnesses, they have a very different view of life. And they actually, like I was indicating before, I just thought that was how everybody was. I didn't know that I was different and having a different experience of life to the people around me. So when someone, and you know, initially when I was challenged, I just put up the walls and went, no, there's nothing wrong with me. So you've got that hurdle of somebody accepting that they need help. And sometimes all you can do is very gently approach that person and initially just say, look, you know, I'm noticing I really love and care for you. I've noticed some changes in you over the last couple of weeks or the couple of months. And I'm just quite concerned. Are you concerned about you and how you're living or whatever you want to say? And if they say, I'm fine, then you really have to step back and wait for them to really have it. But you've sown that seed. And you might then very gently say something like, well, it's just that I've noticed that you're not doing this or that, and you seem a bit withdrawn. And I'm just wondering if there's anything you'd like to talk about. Know that I'm always here for you, moving forward. And that's really all you can do because in my experience, if you go in heavy-handed and go, look, eating disorders, for example, you're not eating properly, you're not doing this, da-da. You're just adding to the challenge of it all and the stress of it all. And they're just going to run out the door and you've lost your opportunity to actually support that person. So, you know, you just have to be very, very careful how you actually speak it. You know, things like, are you feeling okay? I'm just wondering, because I actually know of a person, you know, you could make it up, of a person who was sort of doing something, and a friend told me that blah, 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 you know, and it's just made me think of you. And so I'm being very careful today because I don't want you to think that I'm accusing you, but I just have concerns and I wouldn't like to see you know, ending up going down a pathway that might not be beneficial for you. So no, I'm here to help you. That's about all you can do until they accept that something needs to be done. Of course, it's age appropriate as well. And in my field of eating disorders in particular, you know, as a 12-year-old, 13, 14, 15-year-old, obviously parents need to take control in that one. And that child might go yelling and screaming. But the best way to deal with that is to do your research and find the person that's best going to support you in your situation, who you think's going to do that role for you. And perhaps go and connect with them one-on-one before you bring the child into the situation and ask for their guidance and their support on how are we going to do this? I've got a child that's not eating, a child that's lost da 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 da. I need your help to tell me how to best approach this situation. And then you've got that credible person on board with you guiding that process. And sometimes you do have to intervene and just pick that child up and take them to the situation and know that they're going to be fighting you, but be guided by that practitioner that you've employed on your behalf to help you navigate. And as a parent, be prepared to be yelled at and screamed at and all of those things, knowing that this is normal at the beginning stages, but you will be able to see it through and your child will, get back on track and hopefully thank you one day for caring. I know that there was one thing, in the questions, what are the red flags that you're looking for? And that can be another helpful way of helping a person to help you sort of work out, well, am I making this up in my head? Or do I think my friend or my sister, brother, actually, there is an issue here? So, in regards to eating disorders, the red flags is obvious changes in the way they're eating, their diet. They've all of a sudden cut the amount of food they're eating in half. They're all of a sudden, I don't want to eat pasta anymore. I won't eat bananas anymore. This was a favorite food once, and all of a sudden they're ruling it out. They're perhaps avoiding mealtime. They're making out that they're not hungry, that they've eaten at school today, or they had a huge afternoon tea and they don't want to have the evening meal. They're becoming withdrawn. They're spending a lot of time in their bedroom. They're starting to shut down and not have social gathering, meetings as much anymore as well. So any excuses not to eat, any excuses not to go with the family on social occasions where food might be involved, they are the sort of things that are red flags for eating disorders. Or if you see your child, you might catch your child out. Like I was never caught out, stuffing myself with food. But if a parent came in and all of a sudden in the middle of the night caught their child in the fridge, stuffing themselves with food, then you've got an issue here that needs to be confronted. But gentle, gentle every way. You can only sow a seed, sow a seed, sow a seed. But it can't be challenging. It can't be confronting. It can't be delivered with angry words. It needs to always be delivered with love and care. And things like, well, I have my concerns. And when you're ready, I'm here for you. And then go and do your homework, get someone credible. And as I said, help use their wisdom and their guidance too, because everyone's an individual. So you haven't got one size fits all here. Because you're dealing with different individuals who's got different patterns and different reasons why they've ended up and culminated in an eating disorder. So you need to be able to almost get to know the person via the parent so you then know how to create an appropriate approach to hopefully help that person acknowledge the problem and then want to deal with it and keep moving forward with it as well.
Thanks for the insights and tips there, JL. So you kind of brought us to a journey where, okay, we identify maybe someone that we care about has an issue, but let's say they're ready to take that next step and, stop by JL's office and have that for a session. And so let's say it was me and I was ready to do that. I'm just kind of curious, like, what is high level? Like, what are like the steps that you kind of take, maybe your first few steps, your approach to, I guess, triaging someone that, needs help?
Well, the first thing is to develop the relationship. If I haven't got a trusted safety relationship with the person who's come into my rooms, then they're wasting their time. So I've got to make sure that right from the get-go, that person feels comfortable with me, that I'm accepting who they are at the time where they are in their life, that I am expressing a lot of interest in getting to know who they are. So I will have, my first question is usually, Hi, Ben. What brings you here today? And why have you selected me? Is there a certain person that has, and why did I stand out as someone to come and connect with? And to find out what they already know about me as well, and whether they've done their homework and their research, and whether they really know why they've come to see me in the first place. So I want to know who they are and why they've come to me. And what do they hope to gain by knowing me? What do they want to learn about themselves? And what is the issue that they feel they currently have? And therefore, how is that being expressed in the illness that they're currently carrying? So I'm doing a broad overview initially of where they think they are at. I want them to assess their situation, where they're at for now. And then once I've established that relationship, and I'll also have conversations about, tell me a little bit more about yourself. What do you love doing? What are your interests? What are the things you love doing? What are your friendship groups like? And blah, blah. I want to know about this person. And then gradually you would bring in, okay, why do you think what do you think you're experiencing? I'm experiencing an eating disorder. Tell me about your eating disorder. What are you doing? I want to know the behaviors that they're doing and how that's playing out in their life. So I'm building a clear picture in my mind as to how that person is living their life currently. And then once I've got that clear picture, I would then go to the next step of, okay, why do you think you're here? Why do you think this has developed for you? I'd like to hear your ideas before I share any thoughts that I might have. And then I want to go back in the chapters of your life, and I want to look at different chapters of your life. And where did you feel this change from, what was your life like before? And when did that change come in? Is it a year ago, 6 months ago, a week ago? And what was happening in your life at that time? What was the trigger that finally pushed you into thinking that an eating disorder was the way of life for you? So there's a lot of exploration going on about their life because I want to hear about that. And in the meantime, I'm picking up on different story elements that I feel pretty sure if I put all those lines together, we've got some pretty, concrete reasons as to why this eating disorder has come along. Can you begin to connect with your eating disorder as a positive entity in your life, which is a really hard thing to face? Like, I just want to get rid of this, it's ruining my life. And I try to get clients to look at, okay, it's not really great, but what is this eating disorder teaching you about you and your life? So it hasn't just turned up to make your life awful, it's turned up to teach you something and show you something so that you can learn those important lessons and apply them to your healthy life moving forward. And you have to gauge when someone's ready to, because the more you can connect with your illness and see it as your friend rather than your foe, as something that's come in to inform you and guide you and get you back on track, the more you can more peacefully work with the ideas that come up and identified for you. And so when you've done all that groundwork, and then okay, let's look at your whys. Why do you think you've got an eating disorder? What from your story has contributed? Where would you like to start? Which why are we going to explore first? And then we'll look at the why. So we look at the thoughts attached to that reason. For me, no one will like you as I'm being, if you tell anyone I'm abusing you, no one will like you. So my thought, no one will like me. How did that play out in behavior? It played out with me looking over my shoulder all the time, changing myself because I wanted everyone to like me, and I was always on edge, and I had to have my hair right and stuff. It was doing a lot of things to me. Emotionally, I was sad and depressed and unhappy. And physically, look, headaches, tightness in muscles, all of those sorts of things. That's how that single thought was impacting me that then spilt over and developed into an eating disorder. So I get them to go through those areas that we talked about at the very beginning of this podcast, your thoughts, your behaviors, etc. And then once we've done that, okay, let's look at your needs and your values. Let's look at this. Let's just unpack your entire life and put it back together again. And so in a session, you'll come up with having looked at a why, having looked at something that you want to make a change to, and you come up with a plan. And so again, you throw it over to the client. Okay, how do you think you could play that out in your life? How would you see that over the next week or 2 weeks when I see you again? How would you like to implement that? Let's have a look at some different ways of doing it. And they might come up with two or three ideas, and I might offer one. And then we'll combine them or tweak them or whatever, and we'll come up with a plan. And then I make sure before that person walks, it works out that they've got that plan down pat. And then off they go. And when they come back, that's where we'll pick up from. How did your plan go? What worked? What didn't work? And if they come back and it just was a complete in their idea of failure, wasn't a failure, it was an opportunity to learn. So, okay, this was meant to go this way because there's a little bit more learning so we can tweak the plan and get it right next time. So it's very client-centered based, guiding them, because the other aspect of reality therapy is it's based on choice theory. And so it's based on you having the choice of how you will connect to and relate to your life. So, what choices are going to nurture and nourish and get you back to thriving, and which ones aren't? So, it's that process of looking at your life, seeing where that disruption has occurred, and null and voiding that disruption by replacing it with something positive that sits with your beliefs, your values, and meets your needs and wants, and all of those things. What else have I got here? Trust is the word that I've got. So I need to make sure that they're trusting me. And of course, as I go along, I'll bring in little bits of my story every now and then. If they get a bit stuck, I say, I remember being like that. This is what I did. I'm not saying it's right for you, but let's see. This is what I did. Now, what can we take from that that you might be able to apply to your life? And I find that clients really begin to connect once you open up about your story and your struggles. That gives them more confidence and more trust that this person really can help them moving forward. So that's what I do.
Excellent. Yeah, no, thanks for that broad overview. I think that's really great. It's just really sounds like you're kind of their coach in a way, and sharing experiences when you were playing your sports kind of in a way, and then now this is like, okay, I've been through all those things, and now this is where things are at, and just yeah, just supportive coaching approach. Yeah, that sounds really good. So I wanted to pivot now to your book, and you wrote a book, and just wondering, what are your main inspirations behind the book? Was it just maybe to, oh, there it is. Okay. So just curious, was this a way to maybe, help those that maybe are suffering in silence that want to just maybe try to read, like an experience, or maybe it was also another way for you to put closure that you have, overcome your challenges, and this was a way to kind of summarize things for yourself so you can move forward. I just wondered, yeah, I can just share a little bit about the inspirations behind it.
Okay, so I know when I came to write the book that I was pretty well done and dusted in the recovery process. But I was being encouraged by a number of people. Jenny Lee, you've got to write your story. There are so many people out there that will benefit from reading your story and how you navigated your way through and all the inspirations and learnings that you have to share now with people out there. You've got to write your book. And I was putting it off. And then I decided to go into public speaking. And to develop an online offering for people with eating disorders. And I connected with a group in Perth actually called Fempire, and they guide and lead women entrepreneurs who are developing these sorts of lifestyles for themselves. And the leader of that, Marnie Lefebvre, said to me, you got to write your book because your book is your real estate when you're doing public speaking. And I went, oh, I'm not going to get out of this. So I went to Sydney and looked after my daughter's two hairless cats, Mystique and Logan. And while they went overseas on a holiday, and I wrote my book and surprisingly wrote it in a month. And I think you can do that when you've gotten to the end and your story's all there ready to just type up into words. So that was the real reason. It was because people were encouraging me because they thought it would be very beneficial for others. And which has turned out to be the case. And I've also found through that process, I had written a lot of verse or a lot of poetry throughout my healing years as well, and found out that I could do that pretty well. And I also found out in the end that I was a pretty good writer. So it all came together rather easily. So my first book, Anorexia Unlocked, Understanding a Story Through Mine, The first part of it is about 27, I think, chapters, and just lays out my life. Obviously, not every aspect of it. We'd have to have a volume of them, but just starting from the age of two, that's the opening part and that story, and then how that impacted my life moving forward. And in the middle of it, I've got 14 what I call pearls of wisdom, and that's the inspiration, the things that I felt I learned that I would like other people to hear and perhaps learn from or adopt to their life moving forward. And then the last bit is just a few words where I sort of just put it in an overview summary. This is what happened. Reality therapy came along. I looked at, I did all this, and it's sort of a summing up of how I use reality therapy to in the recovery process. So that was book number one, and I'm really proud to say that the people that have read it have all come back and said that was so useful. And probably 90% of them, once they pick it up, they don't put it down till they've finished reading it. So it's been a worthwhile thing to perhaps do and offer to people to learn from and read from. So as a result of that, I've actually got two more hopefully coming out before Christmas. My formatter is actually in Canada, and I'm yet to hear back from her. She has the two manuscripts. And the second one is called Recovery and All That Jazz: Mental Illness, Life Events, and True Understanding. I had about 200 verses, all this poetry hanging around, and I thought, well, let's do something with it. So I took about 45 from the archives and I added five more to make it all relevant as a coherent book. And in that one, the verse is represented first, and then I write however long is required to explain the meaning of the verse and the inspiration. I embed elements of my story into it, and just what readers can take from that and hopefully learn and adopt and apply to their own healing journey from mental illness. So it's not specific to eating disorders, this in breath, because I had a lot of mental illness development, not just the eating disorder. And then the third book, I thought, look, I've got about 100 verses left, just hanging. And look, I don't know if anyone will buy this one, but I just wanted to entertain myself and see it in print. So that one I've called Echoes from My Heart: My Words Gifted to You to Comfort, Guide, Inspire. And it's just a whole book of verses, some long, some quite short. And it's one of those type of books that you just hold in your hand when you're not feeling great and you go, I need a message from the universe today. And you just allow the book to open and you just read the verse that pops up in front of you. And hopefully it will speak to you and just support and nurture you in that moment when you feel like you need a little bit of a lift. So those two books hopefully out, and then I'll have my trilogy. It was my aim and I've achieved it. So yeah, that's why my books came about.
Excellent. Yeah, thanks for sharing, JL. So, as we wind down this podcast, I always like to ask my guests a two-part question. And here it is. So, what are you most grateful for, and what are you most looking forward to in the future?
I am most grateful for my two children. I get a little bit teary because I know that if Brad and Kimberly didn't exist, I wouldn't be sitting here with you today. They are the reason I didn't end my life in my mid to late 30s because it meant leaving them behind and leaving them with an awful trauma and way too many questions as to why their mother would do this and it would ruin their lives. So I am very, very grateful for someone who didn't want to have children that Brad and Kimberly came along and gave me the experiences that they did as a mother that I had to, because they really helped me. I was so fear-driven and such the perfectionist, and I needed to have two perfect children. And I've already indicated that Kimberly was nowhere near, I mean, she is a perfect child. She's her perfect self, but she challenged me and challenged me on my parenting and wanting to be herself. And she was the greatest gift in helping me let go of perfectionism so that I could allow my two children to develop into the people that they naturally were rather than the one I wanted them to be. So I'm really grateful that I was given the gift of children. I'm really grateful now that I've had this eating disorder and the mental illnesses that I've had because obviously I'm a very different person. I was a very quiet, very withdrawn person, and I'm certainly not that person today, but I have a wealth of knowledge that I wouldn't have had that has made me a better mother, a better friend, a much better secondary teacher, to the students that I've had the privilege of connecting with. And I've had some really difficult students, that I've come up against. And it was the reality therapy learning that gave me the ability to be able to deal with that much more effectively, so that those students that I've had run-ins with, I could navigate through and get back on track with them and teach them better ways and better choices in life and get on really well with. So I'm really, really grateful for all of that. I'm grateful to myself for having the strength to stay and not leave. And I acknowledge that I've endured a great deal in life, as far too many of us on this planet has. And I'm really grateful to my inner strength for giving me the ability to stay and keep fighting when leaving would have been a much easier choice. I've got a few things written down here. I'm grateful that I'm now being able to put all of my knowledge and wisdom into the online programs on jlkeys.com.au called Anorexia Unlocked. But look, people with mental illnesses, it's just the way it went, but people with mental illnesses would gain from going through the processes that I suggest in those programs as well. And the reason I put them online was because sometimes when you first start out, you don't want anyone to know. And so if you can connect online and get an online program and begin to educate yourself in a way through the eyes of someone who's lived it before, that might be a really good place to start. Yeah, I'm looking forward to. Because I wrote down something else this morning. Let me just remember why I wrote it. I did write down, I'm looking forward to my book selling. You don't make a lot of money out of books, people. But I just want people to hear the message, I suppose, and hopefully gain from that, so that, they can turn their lives around as well. I'm really looking forward to the day when society goes, we need to hear the stories of the every ordinary person who has really struggled and learned from the ground up what it is to survive and navigate your way through difficulties. I think we give a lot of credence to celebrity, and celebrity, we tend to take more notice if it's a celebrity coming out. And I'm not belittling their struggle. Their struggles are real and everything, but people tend to listen more and everything to them. Whereas I would like to have the ordinary, everyday person, I was going to say Australian, but Canadian or whoever, being heard on the platform and not being dismissed and learning from the journey, because they've really started from zero and they've had to get to somewhere, at the other end. And to me, that's just a wonderful, wonderful gift to give somebody else to hear that life of that particular person. Yeah, I think that's it. Oh, and I've had a grandson, my first grandchild. So I'm looking forward to getting to know Chester. That's a name I'm getting used to. Brandon Page, don't listen to this podcast. He's a beautiful little boy, and I really look for, and this is again, and I'm so glad I'm not the person I was, and I'm the person with reality therapy in me, because I know that I'll relate to that little lad a lot more differently, and I'll be looking forward to getting to know who he is and him showing me who he is, rather than nanny going, no, you've got to do it this way. So I'm looking forward to that moving forward as well.
Well, congrats on Chester, and I say it's been awesome having you on, JL. You've mentioned something about your website there, and just wondering if people want to learn more about you, what are the other platforms that they can find you at?
Look, the best one is to go to my website, JLKeys, KEEZ.com.au, because all of the resources that I offer, and I've got some blogs on there as well. I'm also a writer for Brains online magazine now, and I've only just started there. So those articles will come through and be loaded in on my website. I think that's where I put everything that I'm doing and everything that I'm about. So it's the central place to go to. I am on Instagram. I do have a Facebook business page, and I am on LinkedIn as well. But I find, to know about who I am and what I present and what I offer, the website is probably the best central place for people to go to. I also, gosh, I haven't put it on my website yet. I've got a few things for my website designer to add to it. I do have a Calendly, a subscription now as well for people to book a free one-on-one Zoom session with me if they would like to sort of have a chat and see whether, I'm a good fit for their recovery story moving forward. We might be able to add that perhaps under this, if you don't mind, Ben. And so people can book through that if they would like to. Or my private email. I don't mind receiving emails from people, and that's hello@jlkeys.com.au. And you can write an email and I will answer it as soon as I can. If anything today has tweaked someone's interest or resonated with them and they want to get to know me better, then please reach out via that business email as well. Happy to respond and connect.
Excellent. Yeah, thanks for that, JL, and we'll be sure to add that to our show notes. So that's a wrap for episode 7. Thanks for joining us, and namaste, everyone.